This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. This is Hussein Mohsen, and today I'll be talking with Roberto Gonzalez, author of Connected: How a Mexican Village Built Its Own Cell Phone Network. This is a book at the intersection of anthropology, history of science and technology, and Latin American studies. Dr. Gonzalez is a cultural anthropologist whose work focuses on science, technology, and society, militarization and culture, processes of social and cultural control, and ethics in social science. He is currently the chair of the Department of Anthropology at San Jose State University in California, and a prolific author and editor of several books, the most recent of which is Connected, which we will discuss today. Roberto, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Hussein, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, I'm glad you're with us. And before we delve into the book, I'd like to ask you about your own story, particularly where did you go for grad school, and how did you become interested in the book's topic?
Sure. Well, I'm originally from the South Texas border area. I grew up in a small town at the very southern tip of the state of Texas. And I didn't come to anthropology right away. I studied mechanical engineering for 4 years at the University of Texas at Austin. And then as a senior, I discovered the social sciences. And in fact, the first course I took in social sciences was an introductory course in cultural anthropology, which changed my life because I changed my major very soon after that. Very soon afterwards, I began applying to graduate programs, and to my surprise, I was accepted at UC Berkeley and started studying anthropology there in the early 1990s. Although I became a cultural anthropologist, I always held on to that interest in science and technology. That's probably part of my 4 years of training as a mechanical engineering student. And I think I've always held on to that interest in science and technology. And the most recent book, Connected, is, I think, an attempt to bridge those two areas of interest for me, which are the world of culture and social organization, and the world of science and technology, especially 21st century digital communications technologies.
That's quite interesting. In the beginning of the book, and touching on the title, you start by differentiating between connection and communication. Can you tell us a bit more about this distinction?
Sure. Yes, I see. The way I do it in the book is by looking at the etymology of these two terms. I think oftentimes these days we use the terms in the United States interchangeably, as if communication is always a form of connection, or as if the two are somehow equivalent to one another. And after thinking about it more, I realized that communication and connection are two often quite different things. And part of the reason I come to that conclusion is thinking about, again, the root of the words. Communication has to do with relationships and an interchange between people in particular. And as such, I interpret communication as something that can be often improvised, and where you can, for example, in a conversation, move back and forth. So I think the idea of a conversation is something very different from the idea of a connection. Connection comes from the same root word as nexus, which means linkage, linked in a sense. And so one of the observations I make in the book early on is that connections often have a kind of a kind of aspect to them in which you're locked into something. And I think social media is a good example of this. When we interact on social media, there's often this sense of obligation and linkage between the messenger and the recipient of the message. That's quite different, I would say, than a conversation, which tends to be, at least in my mind, more open-ended.
We will certainly touch on these topics during the interview. But in the first chapter, you start setting the ground for the story of the book, which takes place in the pueblo of Talea. You first start telling us about a brief history of the state of Oaxaca, and then a small, not necessarily a small region, but a part of Oaxaca and the northern part of the state, the Rincon, before moving to tell us about the town of Talea. But there's a principle that you start with, which is the principle of comunalidad, which was first articulated in the late 1980s. And this is a principle that was shaped by multiple other factors, including resistance to colonialism historically and resistance also to privatization. What is this principle, and how, in an introductory form, does it relate to the story of the book?
Sure. Well, as you stated, the book is set in a small indigenous community in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. The full name of the community is Talea de Castro, and it's a community of about 2,500 people. It's a face-to-face community that I lived in for 2 years as a graduate student in the 1990s, and so I've become very familiar with people in the community over time. The villagers, for the most part, speak two languages. Most are bilingual in Spanish and Zapotec, Zapotec being one of the largest indigenous languages in terms of the number of speakers in Mexico. Now, the principle of comunalidad, you are correct. It was, I think, explicitly articulated during the 1980s and 90s by a couple of indigenous intellectuals, the Zapotec anthropologist Jaime Martinez Luna being one, and the Mije scholar Floriberto Diaz being the second. The Mije are also a very large indigenous group from the state of Oaxaca. And the idea essentially of comunalidad is and you can tell just from the word itself that it has to do with communality. That's a literal translation of this concept of comunalidad. Translated to English, it would be communality. From the point of view of these scholars who developed the idea in the 1980s, really, there are several different dimensions to comunalidad. And behind them all is the idea of collective celebration on the one hand, as experienced through the fiestas that these villages celebrate several times a year. The notion of collective labor, shared labor, which is connected with a form called the tequio, which are literally, you can think of them as work parties where citizens, adult citizens are required, instead of paying taxes, they're required to dedicate several days of service every year to the village government. And that could be for the construction of roads or for the maintenance of streets or sewage and different kinds of infrastructural projects that the village may have going on. And then communality has another dimension as well, which is the notion of collective gift giving or sharing. And that is demonstrated most clearly through the practice of what in Oaxaca is called the gozona. That's an indigenous word that basically means a gift. So this is the principle of reciprocal exchange. For example, if there's a wedding or a funeral, or work that needs to be done in the fields, you give the gift of food or labor or volunteer service to your neighbor with the idea that at some point in the future, that person will return the favor to you. So these are three of the key aspects of comunalidad. It's this sense of collective identity and collective life as expressed through festival and feasting, as expressed through work, and the obligation to provide labor to the community itself. And then third, through gift giving and reciprocity.
Beside the comunidad principle, you tell us about a quite interesting aspect that often goes overlooked about the Rincon region, and which you also describe as an extraordinary service to humanity. It has to do with the scientific experiments and knowledge that are disseminated by the Rincon farmers about the maize crops. What's this extraordinary service?
Sure. This is much more directly related to my first book, which was essentially a book about the farmers of the Rincon area, which are the vast majority of families are farming families or campesinos. But drawing on the research of others, including archaeologists and ethnobotanists and historians, it became clear to me in the process of doing my work on farmers in the Rincon that the service that these people are providing to humanity is that they are essentially the safeguards of the biological diversity of maize, which is, as I'm sure you know, one of the most important food crops on the planet. And so what they have been able to do over the course of several thousand years is to maintain this enormously rich genetic diversity in this one particular species of corn, by maintaining literally thousands of different what are called land races or varieties that basically safeguard the security, the biosecurity of the world's corn supply. To me, that's significant because I think the stereotype of campesino small-scale farmers is often that they are unsophisticated or that they somehow are not scientific in their approach. And what I found in living in this community during the 1990s and early 2000s was entirely the opposite, that these were very inquisitive scientists who loved adopting new crops or experimenting with new crops to see if they would succeed, and who were committed, absolutely committed, to maintaining the diversity of maize, of corn, which is at the base of their food supply. It also so happens that the Rincon lies very close to the original point of domestication of maize. And that has come out of a lot of bioarchaeological research and ethnobotanical research over the years. So to me, that really sensitized me to the real talent that the people of this region of Oaxaca have in terms of innovation and experimentation and the scientific method, they've got this kind of sophisticated view of experimentation and adopting what works and rejecting what doesn't.
In addition to farmers, you tell us about what we can call another group of protagonists in the story. They are the intermediaries. Intermediaries historically had different roles. And regarding the topic of the book, they were very instrumental to the very construction of the local cell network. Who are the intermediaries in our times, and how did they broadly help connect the dots to build the network?
Sure. Well, as I said, my first book, Zapotec Science, was about the farmers of this village. But there's another very important group of people who I do refer to in the book as the native intermediaries. And this is following the work of the historian Yana Yanakakis, who's looked at this class of indigenous people, but during the Spanish colonial period. And she describes them as playing a critical role as liaisons between the majority indigenous population and the Spanish colonizers of that time, being the 1500s through the 1800s. Today, the native intermediaries are different to the extent that they are not necessarily elites in an economic sense, but they tend to be elites in the sense that they often have more formal education in schools and universities. So in Talea, this community of 2,400 people, there are probably, I would say, about 500 of them or so that have gone off to get either high school or college degrees, or in some cases both, and have decided to return to the village. Now, you can't get a university degree or a college degree or a high school degree in Talea because there are no high schools, much less universities. So you have to leave to the cities if you want that level of higher education, a formal education, I should say. Now, these people, once they return to Talea after having lived in the city for several years, often come with very new ideas and expectations and goals compared to their fellow citizens, many of whom rarely leave the village. There's no reason really for a campesino or a farmer to leave Talea, especially if he or she is committed to farming the fields on a daily basis. So these native intermediaries, you can think of as people that have an urban outlook because they have lived in the city for 5 or perhaps 10 or 15 years or more. In some cases, they have lived in the United States, in Los Angeles or Seattle, and have made a conscious decision to return to the village for various reasons. But they come with a very different, a very different worldview and a very different set of aspirations. And that group is the group that played the critical role in helping to launch the cell phone network, this autonomous community-based cell phone network in 2013. Now, the role that they played specifically in this case was first to launch a community radio station, which was, I guess you can think of it in a way, as a pirate radio station because it did not have the approval of the government regulatory agencies. But then more importantly, a few years later, what they did was to serve as liaisons between a non-governmental organization, an NGO called Rhizomatica, that had the technical expertise and the relationships with technical experts that helped the village launch their own cell phone network. So it's not as if this village was able to create its own cell phone network out of whole cloth or without any help. But the role of the native intermediaries was to build a bridge between the village and its government on the one hand, and on the other hand, these two or three different NGOs who actually helped build the technological infrastructure to make it happen.
I'll get later in the interview to the NGO in particular, because I could tell while reading the book that you were critical, as other Talian characters in the book, who were unhappy with how the NGO managed the work. But before doing so, you tell us about Talia as a, like we said, some a place where there is commonly that, but also it's a place that's historically valid autonomy to a great extent, but also had openness to its surroundings and to the world. There are developments that started around the mid-19th century that have led Talia to become one of the most important cultural and commercial hubs in the Rincon region. What were these developments?
Yes, well, we could go way back, as I said, into the even prior to the 20th century. Yes, in the 19th century, early 19th century, actually, this region became a very important center for mining, first when it was a part of the Spanish Empire, and then later on, after the creation of the Mexican national state in the 1820s. So for that reason, Talia became very important because of the silver mines that lay nearby. And as a market town, Talia itself, the modern history of Talia, is really a history of the development of a market town that supported the miners and provided food and supplies to them. So it became a kind of commercial hub more than 100 years ago and has maintained that position ever since. Talia, from its very founding in the 1500s, was actually a village that consisted largely of people from different villages. So it was not established as a community until after the Spaniards arrived. And so it's always, I think, been seen as a kind of cosmopolitan place from the point of view of other villages in the Rincón, and one that has always been open to outside people and outside ideas. I think oftentimes we anthropologists, as well as the general public, have a stereotype of indigenous communities as somehow being more or less fundamentally alike and similar. If we think about a rural Mexican indigenous village. But one thing you find out very quickly if you actually live in communities like these, is that there are dramatic varieties from one village to another in terms of worldview, in terms of willingness to accept ideas from outside the region, in terms of its welcoming attitude towards outsiders. And Talea, I would say, is at an extreme in terms of its willingness to embrace outside ideas and outsiders into its community. And I've traveled enough through this part of Oaxaca to know that this is not only Talean's self-image of themselves, but it's also an image that neighboring villagers have of the community as this place being a very open community, sometimes to its detriment. For example, if outsiders come seeking to exploit villagers or that sort of thing. But often that openness has worked to Talea's advantage. And I think the cell phone network is a good example of that.
In addition to this openness to surrounding villages and to the world at large, you also tell us that Taleans attempted also to establish close nexuses with otherworldly beings in the third chapter, which is titled Enchanted. And then you use some examples to establish a link between those rituals that are preserved in Talea and the willingness and the planning to establish a new cell phone network locally in the village. If you can give us an example that has helped you establish this link between the supernatural and the digital form of connectivity.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. First, though, I want to return just once more to the idea of openness, because I mentioned mining, but there's another important aspect to that openness and where it comes from. And that is actually two things that are related. One is the introduction of coffee into the region about 100 years ago, which has become the main cash crop and has linked Talea and opened it up to the global economy for all, for better and worse. And also migration, which has been a hugely important part of village life, so that now literally thousands of people who were born in the village live elsewhere, either in large cities within Mexico, like Mexico City or Tijuana, or in the United States in places like Atlanta, Chicago, and Los Angeles, the greater Los Angeles area. So those are other examples of this sort of openness and how the village itself has become intertwined with the global economy and with global patterns of movement and migration. Now, to answer your question regarding the nexus or connections that the lands have with the supernatural, with the saints and with their gods, and other supernatural entities, and how that is related to digital technologies in the 21st century. At first, it may not seem obvious. It's not until you start looking more closely at the way that Taleans are using their cell phones, or the ways in which Taleans are using, for example, social media or YouTube, just to take that one example, and how the new digital technologies reflect the cultural importance of their ongoing spiritual relationships and connections with supernatural beings. So to me, probably the most obvious example of this would be to look at what I call the virtual village on YouTube, for example. So let me explain what the virtual village is first, and then I'll get to a specific example. The virtual village, I developed this idea in my book as a way to describe a version of Talea that in some ways reflects village life. And so, for example, if we take a platform like YouTube and you do a search on Talea de Castro, you will find literally hundreds of videos posted to YouTube, mostly by Taleans themselves who have filmed these events either with their phones or with cameras and have posted them online. And I call it a virtual village because, yes, it does depict certain moments in the daily life of villagers. But it's virtual in two senses. One, because it is online, not a material version of the village. But two, it also gives a somewhat skewed or distorted view of village life because the vast majority of those posts on YouTube are for events like, for example, fiestas or basketball tournaments or other events that really highlight a special moment in the year of a village. So it's not an accurate, I would say, or even close to accurate representation of what everyday village is like, but it's important nonetheless as a virtual sort of representation that villagers themselves are posting to YouTube. So to give one example of this, some of the most important posts that you find in this virtual village, again, in the example of YouTube, using that example, but we could just as easily look at Facebook or other platforms that villagers are using. What we find are oftentimes ceremonies that have a religious aspect to them, or fiestas, which are at their base religious festivals that are held several times a year. And so I think that's a good example of how the Talayans are using these new technologies of connection to basically demonstrate, but also disseminate their commitment to supernatural forces and their deference to supernatural customs and beings as well.
Well, this is in chapter 6 in particular, which I very much enjoyed when you took, which is titled Posts, and you're exactly right about the posts of Talayans, be it on Facebook or on YouTube. And there's a nuanced perspective and the balanced position that you take with respect to social media and higher connectivity using cell phones in general, where you acknowledge the benefits of having this level of digital connectivity, but also ask the readers not to resort to tech utopianism that's perpetuated by the tech industry that's concentrated in Silicon Valley. If you could give us an example on each side of this call that you make in the chapter.
Sure, yes. Well, as an example of the positive outcomes of the rapid introduction of these new technologies, and here I am talking equally about cell phones, the actual hardware, as well as the kind of platforms that they use to communicate their ideas and so on. The positive side, clearly, for a community with thousands of villagers living either internationally or in very distant cities, is the facility with which they can communicate, the ease with which they can reach out to their relatives who live, in some cases, thousands and thousands of miles away. Apart from that, there's also the advantage of villagers who live, who have migrated elsewhere, to maintain a sense of identity and belonging to the community in which they were born, and oftentimes which they left as teenagers, as very young people. So it has had that benefit, that beneficial effect of reinforcing bonds of community, bonds of family, pride in identity as Indigenous people, in a way that's very different than when I first visited the village in 1994. I mean, back then, to maintain contact with your relatives in Los Angeles, if you had sent a son there, or if your daughter had decided to move to Mexico City, you had to use one of the three telephones in the village and pay lots of money for each minute that you spoke, and then write letters. That was your other option. And so within the space of 20 years or so, all of that has changed. And now you can have daily communication using WhatsApp's chat, video chat function. And so the level of connection, the level of intimacy in terms of communication is dramatically different compared to 20 years ago for that reason. So in some ways that's obvious, but it's also deceptive because as you just noted, that does kind of fall right into the narrative of the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, which take this techno-utopian view that, you know, all these technologies are just drawing us closer together as a global community. And that's a very seductive kind of idea, because there are negative consequences as well. And that's obviously visible in a face-to-face community like Talaya, where, as I demonstrate in the book, we can see a kind of digital divide that's formed within the village itself. Because not everybody has equal access, for example, to social media or to the internet, although cell phones are pretty widespread at this point. internet access is not as straightforward, and not all villagers have it, nor do they necessarily have the time or the leisure to be able to accessing a Facebook account or WhatsApp. So the village is a place with very large class differences, so that you've got some quite affluent families that own stores and may be coffee merchants or may have maybe professionals, maybe doctors, physicians, or school teachers, who have much easier access to the internet than a campesino family that may spend lots of its time out in the fields, that may not have the ease of access to internet and so forth. So one negative consequence is, I think, the increasing digital divide within the village itself. Another negative aspect would be very similar to, I think, what many people have observed in the United States and South Korea and many other places, which is it's the kind of addictive tendency of these technologies, especially among young people. So there are concerns in the village about young teenagers, for example, spending too much time online or being distracted by social media constantly. And then there's another, I think, set of concerns that have emerged as well in many of the communities in this part of Oaxaca and the Rincón, which is the extent to which these technologies can facilitate the spread of disinformation, political propaganda, and other kinds of negative consequences that we've observed in our own society over the past few years. So villagers in a place like Talea are not immune to some of the same downsides of these powerful technologies that that we ourselves are faced with.
You mentioned already the digital divide, which seems to have moved to the inner parts of the village after this higher level of connectivity. But one would ask, why did Talea itself, as a pueblo, didn't have any phone network coverage before year 2013?
Yeah, to me, that was one of the most fascinating parts of the story, because we've talked briefly about the role of the NGO in helping bring service to the village, but we haven't yet asked the question, why didn't the village have cell phone service before, especially since that is a right that's guaranteed in the Mexican Constitution and has been for a long time, equal access to the latest communications technology that's written into the Mexican Constitution. So why is it that that would not be the case and that Talea would not have this technology until 2013? Well, the reason is that first of all, I should say that Talean citizens petitioned some of the multinational corporations that provide telecom service in the country. So this would be America Móvil is the largest, and then Movistar is the second largest. So if you might think of these companies as equivalent to, say, Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile in our own country, they were denied when the villagers asked for service. What the company said is, your village is too remote, it's too far away, and it would be too expensive for us to provide service. And that happened for several years. And this was after several attempts to ask the cell phone companies or the telecom companies to provide service. When that failed, the villagers then reached out to their government officials and their elected officials and pleaded with them, asking them, please provide service. This is something that is considered a right in Mexico. And again, we're largely, they were politely denied their request, again, with the explanation being there's no feasible way for us to provide service. This, of course, fits into a longer pattern of what I would call a kind of neglect on the part of a government and oftentimes on the part of the corporate world, not just in Mexico, but throughout Latin America. Where indigenous communities are not really given a fair opportunity to participate and enjoy in the same kind of things that someone in a city might. And here I'm talking specifically about rural communities, but I think more broadly this applies to indigenous communities as a whole. And so given that situation, and the way I describe it in the book is, to a certain extent, this is a story of David versus Goliath, where you've got this village, which is a kind of David up against incredible odds, finding a way to beat Goliath by making this connection with the NGO to actually create its own mini telecom company without the approval or without the support of government or the private sector or corporations. So big telecom wouldn't help. Big government wouldn't help. So what the villagers did was to basically find their own solution, and they were able to do it themselves with some help, again, from the NGO.
In addition to the NGO, you tell us that there was a conference on indigenous media that took place in 2011 in Talea, where there were, I would say, four main protagonists that led the project of creating the local network. The first two are the founders of the radio station you mentioned earlier, but also there was a chance encounter between two other younger folks at the conference. Who are those four main characters?
Sure. Well, correct. Yes, the first two I mentioned are villagers. I call them Kendra and Abram in the book. These are pseudonyms, you know, to protect their identities. But yes, these were villagers that had been born and raised in Talea, went to Oaxaca City for high school and later for college, and then returned to the village as young adults. And, you know, basically, among other things, created this community radio station. And they were really the leaders of the charge to get this cell phone network going. So yes, the other two people were, and these are their real names, Peter Bloom and Eric Huerta, who are two professionals. Peter Bloom is from the United States originally, but he had experience helping native communities, indigenous communities, create their own communication systems, and got very involved in indigenous media in the state of Oaxaca. And that's really where he got to meet Kendra and Abram, the Talean young people, during this workshop. The other person who was present at that workshop or conference in 2011 was Eric Huerta, and he is a telecommunications lawyer by training. He's a Mexican citizen, but like Peter, was very passionate about providing the kind of technical and legal support that would assist them in creating their own telecommunications network. So this was really the key, I think, meeting of two very sophisticated groups of people. On the one hand, indigenous villagers with experience in do-it-yourself communications. And on the other hand, these very technologically and legally savvy experts from NGOs. And these workshops, oftentimes in rural Oaxaca and other parts of rural Mexico, are very interesting places where you have these kinds of alliances that get formed with very exciting and interesting projects that are often proposed. During my time in the Rincón, many of these projects were often focused on ecotourism and sustainable development projects that were often kind of joint ventures between villages and NGOs based in Oaxaca City. In the 21st century, I think a lot of these experiments are focused around exactly this kind of thing, which is how to provide indigenous villages with all that the digital communications technologies have to offer. And so I think that meeting in 2011 was really kind of representative of lots of projects that have been undertaken over the years between indigenous communities like Talea and NGOs.
You tell us in this chapter about, like you said, the legal acrobatics that the main leaders of the project had to go through, the political and local mobilization, also the assistance of hackers who were able to use open source software to bring all of the pieces of the puzzle together for the first deployment in March 2013, which was considered a big success that brought very affordable services. Like, we're talking about 1.5 cents per minute for calls to the US, for example, which is 1/10 of the price on using landlines. We're talking about local calls and texts for free. Later, this was expanded to free calls to Seattle, Mexico City, and Los Angeles. You tell us about all of those achievements and all of those technical and legal acrobatics that were done and that led the network to become a very popular one. But shortly after, we're talking about a bit more than a year, it seems that powerful institutions, be it corporate or otherwise, were not very happy with this accomplishment. So what happened on May 12, 2014 in a local market in Talea?
Right. Earlier, I mentioned that this story, when I first heard it and read about it, reminded me a great deal of the story of David and Goliath, right? You've got a small community going up against big, powerful institutions and basically slaying the giant, right? And living happily ever after. But what I found out was that what happened in Talea fairly soon after, as you said, just over a year after the introduction of the community network, was that Goliath took charge once again. And the story is a really fascinating one because it seems that really two forces were at work, at least two forces, and actually three. And I'll talk about each of these in turn. The first was a kind of political backlash that happened really just several months after the creation of the cell phone network. So this would have been in 2013. And what happened was that there were several state and a few federal politicians that really did everything they could to try to undermine the cell phone network. So it seems that they may have colluded with local officials in Talea. They very vocally criticized the Talean, the people who were managing Talea cell phone network, accusing them of mismanagement and hinting that they were perhaps misusing funds and things like that. So there was a very clear political effort to undermine the cell phone network. And it's not difficult to understand why that would happen, for me anyway. The cell phone network, the very fact that it had to be created by the villagers themselves, really exposed a kind of the kind of neglect that government had been showing Talea and many other indigenous communities for years. So that was the first factor. The second factor, besides this smear campaign, and it happened, as you say, in May of 2014, was that one of those giant telecom companies, Movistar, actually set up shop in the center of town on a market day. The market is held every Monday. It's like a farmer's market, basically, in Talea. That draws together hundreds and hundreds of villagers from surrounding villages. And what they did was to basically promote or basically announce the arrival of a new cell service that was to be a commercial cell service, promising villagers the opportunity to basically set up a subscription at a discount rate that would allow villagers also to access internet services, something which the community cell phone network did not do at the time. So just to put this in perspective, imagine that you're in a community that has created its own cell phone network, but you can only make calls or texts. You can't use a smartphone in any sort of meaningful way because you cannot access the internet or its services. And then suddenly a company arrives and tells you that for just a little bit more, they'll sign you up for a service in which you can have internet access and data plans and things like that. And so what that led to over time, very quickly, within a matter of months, was many, many hundreds of villagers abandoning the cell phone network that they had created themselves as a community and instead embracing the service that was being offered by Movistar. That's the company that arrived in Talea. They were able to do this, by the way, with the blessing of the village leadership. So every year, new village authorities are elected by the population. And it so happens that this time around, the village leaders were very open to working with Movistar. But it does raise an interesting question, which is why Movistar didn't do this from the very beginning. And in my mind, it's pretty clear that what they were trying to do was to begin to establish new markets in this region that they had ignored for a long time. And also took advantage, they were taking advantage of the situation, I think, to as a kind of public relations stunt, a kind of publicity stunt to make themselves look good and look like they cared about indigenous communities. There's a third factor too that I should probably mention, because I often get the question, why is it that villagers would abandon the cell phone network, the homegrown do-it-yourself network that they did themselves? And the answer to that question is a complicated one. But what it comes down to, I think, is one, let's keep in mind that Movistar, like so many other corporations in Mexico, has a lot of prestige associated with it. And I think a lot of villagers really value that prestige that comes with the power and influence of a big company and being associated with it. I mean, from the point of view of Samtalians, they were the first, right, to not only set up their network, but also to have a commercial service offering internet access. And then the other part of this is that the Talayans, as I mentioned several times in the book, as a community, they are very pragmatic and are not driven so much by ideology, so much as driven by the concept of problem solving. What's the quickest way to get to the solution that we're looking for, to get to the place we want to get to, in this case, in technological terms, in terms of digital technologies? And by 2014, I think for many villagers, the answer to that was clear, which was, let's go ahead and give up our network, our own network, and instead give Movistar a chance to redeem themselves by giving us quality service at an affordable price.
Well, that's a point that's very related to what you bring up in the last chapter, when you talk about the story of the networks, the local networks rise, but then decline, as not necessarily a story of triumph, but also not a story of defeat. And it's rather a departure from this framing of triumph versus defeat, but more of practicality and pragmatism. But I would like to ask about the NGO, because the same NGO whose role was central in the creation of the local network was highlighted as the Movistar campaign was succeeding to replace or dominate the market in Talaya. Some Talayans, including some of the leaders of the local network project, expressed their discontent towards this NGO and accused it of taking kind of a different direction. What was this NGO accused of doing, accused to have done?
Right. Well, let me be clear, because this is, it, in terms of organizations, it can be quite confusing. So the NGO, Raíz Romántica, was the organization that was created by Peter Bloom and Eric Huerta. So this organization is based in Oaxaca City. It still exists. It's still thriving, actually. And what they did was to provide the technical and legal support to actually create the structure, the infrastructure. Once they did their work, they basically left Talaya. They would return every so often to make sure that everything was running smoothly. But the management of the network was placed in the hands of Kendra and Abraham, those two Talayans that were basically, there were new positions created for them within the village government. I believe their titles were something like directors of the Commission of Community Telecommunications. So that was legally speaking, they did not form an NGO. They just maintained and managed the network, including managing the subscriptions, because it did cost something for villagers to actually join as subscribers to the community network in terms of investing in new equipment or upgrading the equipment that they had and so forth. So the problems within the village itself, the internal problems, were more like villagers, people from Talaya, beginning to criticize the managers, the local managers who were villagers also, of mismanagement, of lack of transparency, of ineffective management, and so on. I heard nothing but positive comments from villagers about the NGO itself, about Rhizomatica and Peter Bloom and Eric Huerta. The criticism seemed very narrowly focused on the Taleans themselves who were managing the network. And again, this is literally two people. And so there were, for example, accusations that one of the managers was trying to launch a political career, accusations that another one was basically not being transparent about the way funds were being used, and so forth. So it was an unfortunate case in that where there seemed to be some internal tensions that really split the community in some really significant ways that eventually, I think, contributed to the downfall of the community-based network. Because I think on the whole, apart from pragmatism, there's another value that's very important for many Taleans, and it's the idea that let's try to keep peace among ourselves as much as we can. Let's try to live in harmony rather than fight with each other or bicker or factionalize. And I think that's been a kind of survival strategy that has developed over the course of many years, going back to the Spanish colonial period, when it was in communities' best interest to stick together and to show a united front so that they could deal with the exploitation of the Spanish colonizers. So that's my interpretation of what happened. Again, it's hard for me to determine specific questions like, was there really mismanagement or did this really happen? To me, that's really besides the point. What I try to do is give everyone the benefit of the doubt and just assume that people have different interpretations of what happened and try to make some sense of that and put it in a historical and cultural context. As someone who has more than 25 years of experience with the village and being in contact with the people there and learning, continuing to learn about the history and dynamics of this really remarkable place.
In these contexts of both autonomy and pragmatism, you also tell us later in the book that although the local phone network lost most of its customers and it probably now is not working anymore, the story is far from over. For example, the Indigenous Communities Telecommunications Network, the TIC, now provides internet connection and other data services to its customers. And this process is an ongoing one, and it will likely remain so. I know we've held you up for a significant amount of time, but I usually like to wrap up interviews with questions about a contemporary issue that relates to the book's topic. And I know we already talked about misinformation and the spread of misinformation and how social networks could be affecting the social fabric, be it in Talea or pretty much everywhere maybe in the world. So I'd like to ask you, in relation to the recent news about whistleblower Frances Haugen, who recently revealed about Facebook's deception and prioritization of profit over users' well-being and society's well-being at large. It's a very open-ended question, but I'm curious about your perspective, particularly because you are close to Silicon Valley. You are in San Jose, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley, actually. And you study the anthropology of science and technology. So where do you see in the near future these companies heading in terms of their lack of transparency and the accumulation and abuse of power? Will they keep growing in that direction? Or do you think there might be forces that would pull them back or get them to be smaller?
Yeah, well, that's a huge question. And I think that's an open question as well. It's hard to know where things are headed. What I will say is part of the reason that for me, it was very important to do this book is precisely because I'm in the heart of Silicon Valley and I'm surrounded all the time by colleagues and by media that repeat the same line over and over, which is kind of the sense that innovation starts and stops in Silicon Valley. As if, you know, no ideas or creative solutions really come from any other part of the world. It's a very sort of biased and ignorant perspective, I think. And so telling the story of Talea and also of organizations like Rasumatica and TIC, which, as you've just said, it's evidence to me that the Talayan experiment was not so much a failure as the beginning of a new chapter with indigenous communities in Latin America, which is the establishment of autonomous networks using the most modern 21st century digital technologies to get the job done. So to me, to return to the question of the social media giants and the tech industry as a whole, and will they continue their kind of dominance and this very kind of one-sided architecture of the internet and telecommunications more generally? I don't think so. I mean, I think it's hard to tell when, but I look at places like Talea, and it's just one of many, many small, remote indigenous communities throughout the world that are leveraging the technologies to meet their needs and to use the technologies to further their locally based goals. I think the next step in this is going to be the development of locally based social media platforms, socially based alternatives to communication without surveillance, without government interference. I think it's still some time before those things are realized. But if you look at the work of someone like Ramesh Srinivasan, who has written this wonderful book called Beyond the Valley, which is all about innovators in all over the world, in African countries, in Southeast Asian countries. Talea itself is mentioned as an example. It's clear that that something is changing, and it's not always easy to see those changes unless you're doing cultural anthropology, you know, in a remote location where these experiments are happening. But to me, it makes it a very exciting time to be studying the intersection of the anthropology and science and technology studies. There's a lot of work to do, but there's a lot of lessons to be learned through the experiments of places like Talea and many others as well.
So in the last chapter, you tell us how this book project has reconnected you to Talea after you originally did your fieldwork during your doctoral studies in the village. First off, are you still in touch with the friends you made in Talea? And second, what are your current projects that you're working on?
Yeah, I end the book with a very short epilogue, which is very reflective. And in it, I describe how, after having done my doctoral research there in the late 1990s, I continued visiting the village for a few years, but then got really kind of swept up in my own professional obligations as a tenure-track professor at my university. And I had less and less time to stay in contact with villagers. And eventually I did lose touch for almost 10 years. No letters, no phone calls, nothing. And that was the period when I think many of us stopped writing letters and many of us stopped making phone calls and instead started texting or emailing each other. And so I fell victim to that. And I acknowledge that in the epilogue of the book. What wound up happening professionally was that my work took a different turn as well. I became very interested in the anthropology of militarism and militarization as a trend. And so given that interest, it became very easy to lose sight of Talea. For me, it was exciting to take on a new research project. And so I let Talea slip out of focus. I let the Rincón kind of disappear off my radar screen. And it was precisely this case of the cell phones and the struggle to establish their own cell phone network that got me reconnected and gave me a jolt and made me realize how important it was to get back in touch with them. And so I did in 2017, I believe it was. And I've stayed in touch with them ever since. And the fascinating thing has been that it's been mostly first through Skype and more recently through WhatsApp. And so to answer your question, yes, I've stayed very much in touch with the villagers. In fact, just last month, I heard from friends who called me using a WhatsApp telechat. And so we were able to talk for close to an hour and get up to date on events in the village. Right now, the big news is that they've gotten their first COVID vaccines. So people are very happy about that after having been locked down for the last year and a half and not permitting any vehicles or people from the outside to come in. That's been very difficult for villagers, as you might imagine, because they see themselves as a very open pueblo, and to have to lock down for this reason has been difficult to them. At the same time, the cell phones have made it easier to bear with that reality and to deal with it. And so I've got two projects at the moment, one that I'm still in the very early stages of thinking through, but it has precisely to do with this. How is Talea dealt with the COVID crisis? And it's been in the headlines, this little village of just over 2,000 people. Recently, it's been in the Mexican media because up until very, very recently, they had no COVID cases whatsoever. And it's not the geographical remoteness, but it's the very abrupt and swift decision that village authorities made to lock down the village and enforce social distancing and a curfew and all the rest of the steps that they felt they needed to do to maintain public health. So in my mind, I'm thinking about that as a possible book project for the future, is how this village stopped COVID in its tracks. And now, as I said, happily they have access to vaccines now. So hopefully things will get better for them soon in terms of them being able to open up again. The other project is somewhat different, but it's the common theme here is the technology angle. And this project is finished up pretty much now. And it's a project on militarization, and it has to do with the uses of big data by military and intelligence agencies. And so I've wrote a book on that topic over the last 4 or 5 years, which happily will be out also soon in April with University of California Press. And so, yes, I'm just, excited to be able to do these two very different lines of research at the same time. And it's just been a real pleasure to be able to make the links between those two projects as well.
Well, I look forward to reading the new book. This was a quite interesting conversation. Roberto, thank you for being with us today.
Hossein, thank you so much once again for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to you and to our listeners. Until next episode.